thick words, even if his tone was frankly a little rude. "Do whatever you want, Vivi." So I did. When Thomas Hardware opened, I was right there, waiting on the bus bench with a to-go cup of coffee from Betty's. I chose rollers, painter's tape, a big container of Starry Night Blue, and a smaller one of Sterling. Then I found a ladder in Richard's garage and started in the center of the ceiling, rolling out long strokes. And now it looks like a navy blue hole in an infinitely white universe. Totally worth the crick in my neck, the numbness in my arm, and the feeling that my spine is made of creaky metal instead of flexible muscle and bone. "Vivian," she says, prodding. "Are you kidding me?"
"I had an itch. Remember last winter when you decided the bathroom needed sophisticated wallpaper immediately? Like that." Besides, Richard was glad for the free design advice and labor.
I mean, he probably was. He should be. My mom is narrowing her eyes at me. "Are you not sleeping well?"
"I'm sleeping fine. Are you?"
The passive aggression beneath my question is, "Don't symptomize my sleeplessness as part of a greater problem, because you have artist's insomnia too. And when you don't, it's usually because of an all-natural sedative called Vino."
"Not wonderfully, no,"
she sighs, resigning herself to my whims, as everyone eventually does.
"Well, I'm walking to the farmer's market. Just wanted to make sure you were up for work."
"I'm leaving in a few minutes." When she's gone, I climb down from the ladder and scrub off a few flecks of navy paint from the hardwood floors. I strewed newspapers all over the floor of the bedroom, but I didn't have time to line them up perfectly, too eager to begin my ceiling's darkification. I unbutton the extra-large men's Oxford I use as a painting smock to reveal a divine romper. Basically, it's like my vintage-style bathing suit, halter-necked and tight, only the shorts are a little longer and it's made of a floral-patterned cotton. I slide my feet into sassy gold flats, because I'm already an alchemist today, turning a blank slate ceiling into a good night's sleep, a.k.a. gold. Then I throw on a fedora and a cardigan with elbow patches, giving myself a little chuckle as I pass by the mirror. You simply have to laugh at yourself. When you look like a grandpa on the top layer and a 1940s woman vacationing on the French Riviera underneath. That is to say, fabulous. I make my usual cliffside stop. Today, I stand right on the edge, so close that one step forward would be like the final move in walking the plank. I rest a pill on the pad of my thumb, and then flick it with my middle finger. "Thank you for your service, little pill, but you are no longer needed." With that, I run toward town, skipping through the moss and grass, howling a victory cry, "Ay-yee-yee!" The ocean echoes my sounds against its waters. I know it does, because even the ocean recognizes that I am a wild creature, a spirit child of a vast and star-drunk world. Hurrah! They call these pills lithium, and I like the way the word feels against my mouth. Soft, unassuming, even soothing. Lithium. When the doctor first prescribed lithium, I wondered how the drug companies named it. Like if there's a committee that tried to decide on pretty calming words. I wondered how they picked lith, like Lithuania, lithograph, monolith. It means stone in Greek, I looked it up. And lithium was the weighty stone that pulled me back down when a wild, thrashing windstorm tore me away. But lithium isn't the brand name. It's a chemical element abbreviated LI on the periodic table. But I think it should be line, because it connects my highs and lows into a nice, flat line. But I'm better now. I'm best, even. Besides, I still take my other pill because that one keeps the shadow creatures at bay. Last year, they curled their inky arms around me until my technicolor world became crackling gray static, until I felt nothing but blankness. My phone buzzes in my bag, and I'm delighted to see that it's Jonah, who is one of several elixirs I use. When I kiss him, it's like a sedative. A warm feeling that rushes through my whole body and soothes my busy brain. His prudishness makes anything I do seem filled with intrigue, which is a bonus. He was scandalized that I'd perform a particular act on him in the outdoor shower after a beach trip last week. But I won him over to the idea. "Hello?"
"Viv?"
This is not his voice. Subdued and casual. He's panicked.
Are you at work?
About to unlock the door. Why? What's wrong?
Can you... God, I hate to ask. I can't believe I'm asking. Can you get to Patterson's in the next few minutes?
I open my mouth, but he doesn't pause.
My mom went there this morning, and I thought it was a good sign. But Mr. Patterson just called and said she had some kind of breakdown in the baking aisle or something. I don't know. He said I should come get her because he doesn't want her to drive home. But she took the car, and I have the littles here, and Naomi's at her internship, and Silas didn't pick up the phone at work, and I...
It takes my mind a moment to catch up. But when I get there, I shove my keys right back in my purse. Jonah, listen to me. I'm going to Patterson's, and everything will be fine. Get one of the neighbors to hang out with the littles for like half an hour, then run over here. Okay?
Okay.
I hurry down the street, thanking my half-hour-ago self for putting on flats instead of heels. Inside Patterson's, there's a man with a gray mustache pacing near the entrance. He's wearing a green polo shirt with some kind of vegetable logo. Perhaps Mr. Patterson himself. Hi, I say, trying to sound calm and adult-like. I'm a friend of Jonah Daniels. He'll be here shortly, but he sent me in the meantime.
She's in the back room. Door to your right.
He shakes his head, bewildered and clearly questioning himself.
I don't even know what happened. Found her collapsed to her knees, holding a box of breadcrumbs and having what I think was a panic attack. I wasn't sure what to do. I gave her an empty paper bag to breathe in, like they do on TV.
I give him a nod with a look of severity that I hope says, if you tell anyone about this incident, it would be very poor form indeed, and I will start rumors about wormy produce and salmonella. The supermarket break room is where cheerfulness goes to die. So I'm not sure what he was thinking, sticking her in here. There's a brown plaid sofa that is outdated by half a century, a refrigerator, two vending machines, and a lot of notices posted on the cabinets. Jonah's mom sits upright in a plastic chair behind a round kitchen table, her hands folded in her lap. I'm glad to finally see her in person instead of just in pictures, even if she looks so sad. I know this feeling of being a ghost in your own life. No one sees you. No one feels you. So you stay still as if you could actually disappear at any moment. Hi. My voice sounds abrupt, even though I'm striving for gentleness. I'm Vivi. She glances toward me, managing a weak smile that I know is Jonah's, the one when he is trying his best, but the sadness beneath will not be squelched.
Oh, hello, goodness.
She brushes her hands over her shirt like she's trying to tidy up.
My kids have told me so much about you. I feel like I know you.
I feel like I know you too, but I'm so glad to meet you in person. Sitting in the plastic chair closest to her, I look for the littles in her face. Grief has lined her eyes with an irritated pink. But she's lovely. Fair hair and blue eyes like Leah. And probably a little too thin. Jonah's on his way, but I was just down the street, so I wanted to sit with you until he got here. Mrs. Daniels' voice breaks as she covers her face with her hands.
This is so embarrassing.
I've seen worse. She gives a harsh laugh of self-deprecation, gesturing from her head to her toes, as if summarizing her present situation.
I doubt that. But you're sweet to say so.
I hold my left wrist up to her and slide my sleeve down. The scar runs like a pale river, crooked and winding down my arm. And I feel, as I always do, the desire to erase it. This is perhaps the only time I've been grateful for proof of my former desperation. Her eyes narrow, and she cocks her head. Not in disgust, but in curiosity. I find myself relieved that she's not repulsed by something so ugly. I mean, I'm not sure if the scar itself is ugly. I've never thought about it. But it represents something scary and bottomless. She whispers again, hollowed out this time.
I didn't know.
I'm better now. I have been for a while.
Did they make you take medicine?
She sounds like a child, afraid that the doctor will give her a shot. And I don't blame her.
I'm sorry. Please forget I asked. That was unconscionably rude.
I don't mind. Yes, they did. An antidepressant.
And that helps?
Say the words, Viv. She won't tell Jonah. She needs to hear it. Just spit it out. It's the right thing to do. Do it. Do it. It really does.
The first kind they gave me was a nightmare. The first kind set me off, untethered me, and sent me flying. It began the windstorm.
But this one, I feel like myself still on it.
I'm just so tired. I'm so, so tired all the time.
A tear slips down her face, all the way down till it drops off her chin, and she doesn't brush its trail away. And I remember being in that jungle, lost in the darkest, wildest part of it, where fearsome beasts and carnivorous plants lurk between every tree. All I could do was lie down on the wet leaves. Bugs crawled up my legs, and I couldn't care enough to brush them off. Oh, man, do I know that feeling. But the medicine made me feel enough to get angry, I say. I don't add that the anger makes you powerful. I stood up and sickled myself the hell out of there, hack by hack, slicing through the vines. I screamed until my face turned purple because by then I was a fearsome beast, too. I had lived through the blackness and solitude and emerged roaring at everything in my way. She stays quiet for a few beats.
I only feel angry at myself.
Well, maybe that's a start. The room is silent, except for the hum of the refrigerator as background noise. And I realize there's something important she needs to hear. By the way, I think your kids are the definition of marvelousness, and I've been wanting to tell you that. Based on my own mother's experience, it seems hard enough to raise even one semi-normal child. And you made 6 truly magnificent ones.
Yeah, she says, voice bitter. Some mother I am.
Hey.
We both look up to find Jonah in the doorway. He's winded still, though I can tell his breathing is slower than it would have been after running here. I wonder how long he's been in the doorway. His mom goes repentant immediately, as if his mere presence is accusing her of something. The tears form again in a blink.
I told Jim I could drive myself home, but he wanted me to sit here. I'm so sorry, kid. I don't know what happened. I was fine one minute, then my chest felt so tight and I couldn't breathe. I just wanted to make cookies for you all, and...
Mom, hey. Hey.
Jonah crouches down to her as I clear out of the way.
Don't apologize. You're fine. We're all fine. Let's go home, okay?
But the cart...
I'll get cookie supplies later.
He guides her up and out the door, his hand hovering by her lower back. In the parking lot, we walk on either side of her like bodyguards protecting a star from the paparazzi. Jonah opens the passenger door and shuts it after his mom slides in.
I'm sorry for asking you to come here.
He says this under his breath as we walk around the car, and the wind whips my cardigan enough that I pull it closer. Don't be. I told you, Jonah. I'm not intimidated by other people's pain. He runs his fingers along his brow, pressing hard enough to leave red marks for a moment.
I think I need to tell Felix.
I think you should ask your mom what she needs. Talk to her. Jonah looks up at the sky like the answers will rain down on his face, clearing away the dusty pollen of grief. But it never rains in Verona Cove.
I think I should have told him a long time ago.
Fine. Whatever, Jonah. I snap my fingers. Maybe he heard me, but he's not listening to me. I've got to go to work.
Hey!
He calls.
What did I say?
Did you not even hear me? Stop acting like she has no agency. Holy Mother Earth, Jonah, just ask her questions. His hands rise, a backing off motion.
Okay. God.
As I storm off, I can hear his arms slap against his sides, and I'm sure he's tossed them up in frustration. Then I hear the car start, but I don't look up as they drive off, because he doesn't deserve it. To the deepest, most cellular level of my being, I resent people who believe that depression is the same as weakness, that sad people must be coddled like helpless toddlers. So to think that Jonah, my own boyfriend, my friend,
my lover, whatever he is, would believe that he knows what his mom needs better than she does? That her grief makes her unaskable, voiceless, unreliable? This is very hurtful. My dark days made me strong. Or maybe I already was strong and they made me prove it. Jonah Daniels has his own grief. But he doesn't understand what it feels like to waste away in a castle dungeon where you have been chained to crumbling walls. And when the dragons close in, you only think, good, let this be over. I'm so worked up that my hands are trembling a bit, so clearly I'm in no condition to work at a pottery shop. Imagine the shards, the precious handiwork mishandled by a shakingly indignant former sad girl. Instead, I need to focus on me, on my joy, on my goals. I need a Vivi day, which is like a holiday, only better. As long as I can think of a good excuse, my mom will let me borrow the car, and then I can drive to San Jose. It's 3 hours south of here, but I'll tell her I'm in desperate need of decent shopping, which is sort of true. San Jose is home to a Vespa store, and that's what I need right now. I can already feel it, my body pressed into the California wind at 45 miles an hour and rising, and I'll wear a scarf around my hair like beautiful women in convertibles in old movies. I'll drive the one that goes the fastest. So fast that I outrun every dirty memory scattered like litter behind me. I'll drive it all the way back to Verona Cove, and I will speed past Jonah Daniels, as living proof that sad people can do anything. Living proof that we can ride again, better than before.
Chapter 10. Jonah. I was lying on my bed when my phone rang. My eyes were closed, but I wasn't asleep or trying to be. After the grocery store disaster, I got my mom home and into her room. Then I sprawled face down on my bed and tried to think of nothing. I wished my bed could come to life and transport me to another world, like in kids' books. I'm not sure how Whitney got my number, but she wanted to know if Vivi was with me. "Not since this morning," I said, sitting up. "She never showed up for work, and she isn't answering her phone. I'm a little worried." I worried a lot after that call, until Whitney called me back to say she heard from Vivi. "She went on a day trip," Whitney told me. "She forgot she was supposed to work." That's not true. She knew she was supposed to work. But somehow I pissed her off so much that I drove her out of town. It was a matter of time, if I'm being honest with myself. Now I'm sitting on our driveway with Leah and a box of sidewalk chalk. She's drawing the ocean and a dolphin diving over it. I'm drawing a cluster of question marks in every color. In between them, random arrows spiking up at every angle. Next up, a self-portrait of me tearing out all of my hair. On some level, I'm mad at Felix for not sensing that there is a problem. He came by the house every day for the first month after my dad died, filling our refrigerator and talking with my mom in her room upstairs. Then he stopped. He replaced his visits with the almost daily question, "How's your mommy?" I couldn't verbalize the answer. I couldn't tell him she was asleep for most of the day in a bed covered with crumpled up tissues. It felt too soon to be seriously worried, even though I was. And talking about it felt like I was betraying my mom. So I said, "She's all right." Besides, I didn't want him to ask. I wanted him to stop by the house and see for himself. Then I wanted him to swoop in and fix it. Be the grown-up. In a desperate moment nearly 2 months after my dad died, I invited Felix to family dinner. My plan was that I'd wait for him to come over that night. I hoped to work up the nerve to stand on our porch with him and admit my mom needed more help than we could give her. "You know I'd love to have dinner with you all," he told me. "But your mommy, she asked me not to come by for a while." I was transported to my childhood days in the kitchen, listing off every question that entered my mind. "She did? When? Why?"
"About a month ago,"
he sighed. "She needs time to figure out how to be alone, kid. I know that's hard to hear, but if I'm coming by the house, doing things your dad would have done, I'm taking that from her." "She told you that?" "She did." He laced his big, square hands together. "This is man-to-man talk, see? Stays between you and me." It didn't. I told Naomi and Silas, when we discussed what to do. As usual, we were in our separate corners of the ring. Naomi pushing for therapy and Silas arguing that we need to leave her the hell alone, and me caught somewhere in between and bloodied. A vroom noise pulls my attention to the street.
It gets louder and louder until there's an ice-blue Vespa parked outside our house.
Its rider is bare-legged, and when she pulls off the helmet, I'm surprised to see familiar white blonde curls. Leah bounds toward Vivi, squealing out some very valid questions. Where did the Vespa come from? But Vivi's striding towards us. We have bigger things to talk about. Why don't you go look? I say to Leah as we meet Vivi halfway.
Can I sit on it?
No, I say before Vivi can give her permission. But you can put the helmet on.
You can touch the blue plastic parts, Vivi says. She's like a pony, loves to be petted.
Vivi takes me in, and I realize I'm dusted in chalk,
sage green and ground mustard yellow. She wipes a smudge off my forearm,
thinking hard. Finally, she looks up at me. It was an emotional day, she says. I want to ask what exactly I did to make her so furious, but I don't want to bring it up when she seems not mad. I know, and I'm sorry. I shouldn't have brought you into that situation. I rub at the dull headache that lives above my eyebrow. That wasn't fair of me. It's not your problem, and she places her fingertips over my mouth, halting my clunky apology. Let's not talk about it anymore. Will you come over to my house and make me dinner? My mom's driving down to San Francisco for a gallery opening. And just in case I was going to say no, she drops her hand and kisses me. I pull her in, hands behind her neck. This girl witnessed my mom having a meltdown, and me having a meltdown because I have no idea what I'm doing. And she still comes back.
Ew!
Leah shrieks from across the lawn.
Vivi, that's my brother!
I look down at Vivi, wipe a smudge of blue from her jaw. Wow, lucky you, covered in sidewalk chalk, getting heckled by a 5-year-old. She smiles, like she's in on a really good secret, and says quietly, I like it. The damnedest thing is, she does.
Chapter 11. Vivi.
You told me you were taking my car to San Jose to go shopping, Vivian.
I thought my mom would be gone by the time I got back from Jonah's. But there she was, all dolled up for the gallery event, walking out to the car as I zoomed back from Jonah's on the Vespa. She marched me inside, face as crimson as her skirt.
I was! For a Vespa! I told you I wanted one!
The very nice Vespa salesman loaded it into my mom's car, and I drove it back to Verona Cove. And I had a neighbor help me get it out of the car, and now it's mine. Powder blue and quintessentially me. My mother cannot ruin this.
Why are you freaking out? I bought a helmet.
It's a totally sensible purchase. I already have my motorcycle license, because the guy I was dating when I turned 16 had a bike. And it's a GT, fast enough for the highway. Now I won't have to borrow her car all the time.
This was thousands of dollars, Vivian.
I hate that she keeps saying my full name like it's a swear word.
From a credit card you stole from my wallet.
It's my card, and money Grandma left me. It's not stealing when it's mine.
Her voice becomes hushed, scary.
I confiscated that card from you because you couldn't act responsibly with it. It was understood that purchases go through me first.
I am incandescent with rage, lighting up the kitchen with the redness of my face.
Stop treating me like a child! Do you even hear yourself? I'll be 18 next year!
Her eyes narrow, but I can still see her pupils trying to pierce into me.
You're not taking your pills, are you?
Yes, I am!
I am taking them. Well, one of them. The other I'm taking, too, to the cliff every day so I can watch them fall to their deaths.
Let me see your purse.
What? No! Why?
But then I realize I have nothing to hide.
Fine. Here. She extracts both prescription bottles and dumps the pills out on the table. She counts them and finds, I'm sure, the exact amount there'd be if I were swallowing them all daily. I see her shoulders sag. In defeat or relief, I'm not sure. You can't blame me for being worried. This is how it started last time. Next thing I know, you'll be getting another tattoo without permission. My eyes blur over with angry, hurt, everything all at once, tears. She knows I hate the stupid watercolor lotus inked on my side, that I'm getting it removed, that I recoil from it. Don't talk to me about last time. I'm having a wonderful summer, and I'm better, and you're ruining it by not trusting me. She has no idea. She was there, but she has no idea how scary it got. Like my brain, my body, my whole life was on fast forward and I couldn't push stop or even pause. How low it got after, living with what had happened. And then how numb. How much I missed feeling music in my bones. I remember so much of it, and I would surrender my best vintage sewing patterns to forget. My mom doesn't know the worst of it because I've never told her. Because saying it out loud would be reliving it. Because I know she'd never look at me the same way again. I think I'll cancel tonight, she says quietly. But she's bluffing. She has to be. The gallery is showing one of her paintings. Well, do whatever you want, but I won't even be here, I say, as controlled and prim as I can muster. I'm going over to Jonah's. He's making me dinner. Okay, he's coming over here so we can be alone, but, details schmetails. Her posture relaxes even further. Fists unclenched. Well, that's sweet of him. He's quite the cook, isn't he? He is. As far as my mom's concerned, Jonah can do no wrong. He's so normal, so stable. Living proof that I'm doing fine. She saw him at the farmer's market one day with the littles and wouldn't shut up about how sweet and responsible he seems, how wonderful it is that I'm spending time with such a nice boy. She's right, of course. But he's not so nice that he won't come over when she's not home and make me dinner and spend the rest of the evening in my bedroom. I cover my mouth as if I am thinking very hard, but I'm just hiding my smile. All right, she says, picking up her keys. This conversation is not over, but we're tabling it for now. The Vespa's going back. I'm not happy, Viv.
Jonah shows up an hour later with a brown paper grocery bag. For some reason, this draws me to him even more. Imagining he's my older live-in boyfriend bringing home groceries to our big modern beach house.
This is good timing, he says. I've been working on a few new recipes for the restaurant. You can try one tonight instead of waiting until your birthday party.
I'm getting a birthday party? I clap with delight, and I'm already imagining silly hats and fairy lights.
Jonah rolls his eyes.
You said what you wanted for your birthday was for me to fix up the patio. So that's what I'm doing.
I watch him unpack the groceries and lay them on the table. And there are plenty of things I don't recognize. Something green and leafy that is not exactly normal lettuce. A vegetable that looks like a cross between a potato and a radish. We find pots and pans and spatulas together, roving through Richard's kitchen because my mom and I almost never use it. So I don't know where anything is. Jonah puts salmon in the oven, and he places the potato radishes, which he called red potatoes, into a saucepan of boiling water. My mom said she'd be home late, but even after our fight, I won't be surprised if she has a few glasses of champagne and goes home with another tortured artist. I'll get a regret-filled text message by midnight, but it won't be so regretful that she actually changes her mind. I'm not judging her. I don't want it to sound like I am. Because I understand. I do. My mom wants someone to love her, and I recognize that having a daughter who loves you is not enough, and that she craves to be adored by a steady, interesting, kind-hearted man. I'm not saying I think going home with randoms is the best way to figure it out. But it might be fun, and it's certainly better than staying home and meeting no one. I didn't figure that out on my own, about my mom. My aunt has always been chatty and judgmental about my mom after a glass or two of wine. Because she's not happy in her marriage, and jealous that my mom isn't tied down to anyone. That part I figured out on my own.
I sit on the counter, swinging my legs as I watch Jonah work. It's all so lovely. The easy rhythm as he slices peaches for a salad, the deftness of his hands in every movement between stove and island and sink. This is really beautiful to watch, Jonah. I mean it. It's like watching you speak a different language, you know? It's like when you walk past two people speaking Spanish and you don't understand the meaning of each word, but the sound of it is beautiful, and you can tell they understand each other. That's how you are with food. He smiles, stirring at some kind of sauce.
It's not that complicated.
Well, only because he grew up speaking food.
Hey, Jonah, what's a reduction? Like, it's on menus sometimes, a balsamic reduction or something?
Oh, it's a technique for making a sauce. You heat ingredients in a pan until enough evaporates, reducing it. The remaining sauce is more flavorful, sometimes thicker.
Hmm, good to know. From my seat on the counter, I'm eye level with him, which is new. So I grab him by the front of his shirt and tug him toward me. It's the kind of kissing we sink into so fast, my hands drawn immediately to that gorgeous hair, tugging him in farther. I feel that moment where rational thought swishes out of me, and it's like a lever that propels a train out of the station. I'm gone. There's no stopping me. We're riding this rail all the way to the end. But he pulls his mouth away from mine, and I think he's going to say something sexy to me. But instead, he says,
"The salmon's going to burn."
It takes a moment for me to get my bearings because my mind is so fogged over, levitating above us. You'd think this would hurt my feelings, that my kissing talent isn't enough to distract him, like I can't transport him far enough away from the reality of cooking. But I don't want someone who makes it easy. I don't want someone who follows every slapdash plan that I create in my mind. Jonah Daniels can be such an enigma. There are smudges of my red lipstick across his mouth, making him more delicious than any of the food in this kitchen. I watch him carefully as he lifts the salmon from the oven. Jonah?
Yeah?
Do you want to be a chef?
I think so.
He sets the pan down and lifts up the saucepan from the stove. When he drains the water into the sink, steam swarms the air.
I can't really imagine doing anything else.
So you'll go to culinary school, do you think?
I hope so. Eventually.
After he dumps what I now know to be red potatoes into a bowl, he adds a little milk and a cut of butter. I keep waiting for him to elaborate. But like I said, Jonah Daniels can be an enigma. So I'll prod him. I know we're not in the most comfortable topical territory for Jonah, but it's good for him to talk about his feelings and plans. Would you take over Tony's? Jonah frowns thoughtfully. He matches the potatoes with a silver kitchen tool I don't recognize, and the muscles in his arms flex as he does so. I sit on my hands so they'll stop trying to reach over and unbutton his shirt.
No, I don't think so. At least not for a long time. I love the restaurant, and I love Verona Cove, but I want to live in a bigger city.
The scents carry across the air between us. Faint garlic and melted butter, and another earthy spice that I can't place.
There's school for costume designing, right?
He asks.
Are those in big cities?
New York and L.A., mostly, I think. But I'm sure I can find an apprenticeship with some fabulous designer, because I'm already a rather talented seamstress. Also, I want to go to Japan for at least a year. After that, I'll probably live in California for work. I consider this, opening my mind to the many possible visions I see of my life. But maybe New York, doing TV or indie films. You know, people tend to think of costume design as, like, beautiful, accurately recreated gowns in period films. But there's such an art to costume designing for modern realism, like in TV shows. You have to study the character and know what choices he or she would make, and you help create the idea of the portrayal. You and the writers and the actor or actress and the hair and makeup team.
I can see you doing both,
Jonah says, smiling. He's spooning the smashed red potatoes onto a bed of lettuce called arugula. I'm becoming very well-versed in vegetables tonight. You're right. I'd love to do a current-day TV show, but I'd have to have at least one big sweeping statement movie.
Because, you know, clothes can be the difference between a movie scene and an iconic moment in film.
Oh, yeah?
He looks amused by such a grandiose statement. But I'm right. I'm always right about costume design. Of course. Without the black scoop-back gown, the elbow gloves, and the statement necklace, Audrey Hepburn is just a random girl on a New York City street.
And the tiara.
I blink at him a few times while I process this. What?
She wears a little tiara, too, right? Holly-go-lightly?
He doesn't look up at me because he's carefully placing the salmon onto the mound of mashed potatoes. I'm charmed. Oh, holy Mother Earth, am I ever charmed. You've seen Breakfast at Tiffany's?
Sure. My mom made me watch all those old movies when I was little.
Both plates are almost done now, and he's putting a little more glaze onto the salmon. This whole experience is mouth-watering. And I have to wonder how I got so lucky. A beautiful boy on this beautiful night, making me this beautiful meal. Hey, Jonah?
Yeah?
I don't really know how to break this to you, I say. I hop down from the counter and look up at him. But I think you are maybe falling in love with me. He hands me my plate, and his smile is the faintest bit smug.
Viv, I just made you wild-caught Alaskan salmon baked with mango chutney on a bed of garlic red potatoes and arugula, while talking about an Audrey Hepburn movie. I think you are maybe falling in love with me.
I lift to my tiptoes so I can press my mouth against his. When I return to my heels, I smile right back. Even though there are no maybes at all in this situation, and we both know it, I can be an enigma too. Maybe so, Jonah. Maybe so.
Chapter 12. Jonah. The Verona Cove bonfire is always on the first Saturday after the 4th of July. No one knows who started the tradition. I'm not even sure who brings the firewood or buys the keg, or why the police let it happen. Silas has this theory that the cops let us get it out of our system this one night a year. Probably saves them trouble for the rest of the summer. The usual crowd is high school and college-age townies. It's an unspoken rule. No one under 15, and you age out after college. A few vacationers are invited, but mostly the ones who have stayed in Verona Cove every summer of their lives. From a calendar standpoint, they're one-fourth townie. Naomi decided to walk from our house to the beach with me and Vivi, a surprise to both of us. Not that she said anything on our walk. Vivi has skipped beside me the whole way, asking about who will be here, everyone, and whether they will be fireworks. Yes, but just little ones. In Vivi's presence, it's impossible to deny that I'm weighed down. She's buoyant, feet barely tapping the sand she walks on. Her body seems subject to less gravity than the rest of us. Naomi has always been thin, and her bony shoulders hunch forward a bit. I always thought she had bad posture. I never considered that she'd been as weighed down as I am, except for longer. Even before my dad died, Naomi worried like it was a hobby. About grades, about college, about money, about the other five of us, the environment and pollution. Seriously. Wow, Vivi says. I mean, would you just look at these stars? They're unreal. I love this, being away from any city lights. It feels like if you walked off one of the cliff sides, you could step on each star like lily pads in water and jump from one to another to make your way through the whole solar system. With that, she wraps one arm around me and jumps up to peck me on the cheek. I don't have to look to know Naomi is rolling her eyes. I smile anyway, even though Vivi tugging at me splinters the pain in my already aching back. My whole body is sore from working on the restaurant patio all week, in addition to watching the littles and working my usual shifts. On the first day, I hauled all the miscellaneous crap away. Half of it went into the shed out back, and the other half went to the dump. I called Silas to bring the car and help me move an old, busted oven to the junkyard. Yesterday I ripped up the weed infestation, but I left the ivy. Silas showed up, even though I didn't ask him to. We worked silently, me pulling at the deep-rooted weeds with all my force,
and Silas rerouting the electrical cords and testing which lights still work. Today, I borrowed a power washer from Mr. Thomas, who owns the hardware store beside the restaurant. The patio is, at least, empty and clean. Everyone who uses the alleyway as a shortcut said how great it looks. Mrs. Kowalski said she wants a reservation for the first night the patio opens. I hadn't even thought that far ahead, but Silas and I thanked her anyway. Maybe it's lame, but it feels good to sweat for something I care about. The patio looks a little better each day. Measurable progress in front of my eyes. I don't even mind the ache. I'm used to it. The fire roars in the distance, and there are dark forms all around it. I can smell the smoke already, hear the laughing and chatter. Last year, I came with my friend Zach and a few other guys from the baseball team. I spent most of the night hanging with them and flirting with Sarah. That was when she was a cute Yorkie, not a yippy one. Since I didn't do baseball last spring, I don't even really see those guys anymore. But I can't let myself think about this. About how much can change in a year. It feels like someone driving the heel of their hand into my nose in a street fight I didn't know I was in. As we make our way into the masses, people call out greetings, mostly to Vivi. We pause for a moment as Naomi says hello to a group of old friends and Adam, the guy she dated in high school. When I look back for Vivi, she's a few yards away. She's chatting with Dane Farrow like she knows him, and she's already holding a beer. Dane Farrow is a lowlife. That's the word my dad would have used. Kids at school go to Dane for drugs because his older brother deals. He does too, by association. Pot and Ritalin, I think. He leaves the harder stuff to his brother. I never really think about guys like Dane. I mean, what do I care what he does? Verona Cove is kind of a hippie town, so it's not like weed is a big deal here. But I don't love Vivi talking to him. When Vivi makes her way back to me, I eye her. How do you know Dane Farrow? She says, drawing it out. She's openly considering what to tell me. Like, how and to what degree she will lie. We have a mutual friend. Named Mary Jane? Vivi giggles like it was a joke. He knows Whitney. I met him at work. Oh, relax, Jonah. Don't give me that face. What Dane sells is ditch weed. I'd never buy from him. Would she buy from someone else? We've never talked about it. I've smoked before with friends, but never bought weed. Heard this thing from my mind these days.
Jonah, Naomi, hey!
Ellie's waving at us, walking over from a group of sophomores.
You came!
She hugs Naomi and gives me a shy wave, saying,
I saw the patio, Jonah. It looks so great.
I nod. Thanks. It's getting there.
Ellie, this is Vivi. His girlfriend.
Vivi adds, we haven't had the definition conversation. I try not to react in surprise. Or relief.
It's so good to meet you.
Ellie's tone is genuine as she sticks out her hand. Vivi shakes it daintily, as if Ellie is someone she'd rather not touch.
Leah talked about you nonstop last time I saw her.
Vivi gives her that painted-on smile again, but it's more than her lipstick. She looks like a doll with a permanent smile forced onto her face.
Huh, I haven't heard about you.
I frown because of course Vivi has heard of her. Ellie is Felix's oldest daughter, remember?
Oh, yeah.
Vivi fakes smiles still.
Right.
I feel like I'm a gazelle about to be mauled by two lions. Come on, Elle, Naomi says, taking her hand. Walk with me to the keg. Without another word to Vivi, they're both gone. Maybe Naomi meant to save me, which I guess she did. But it still seemed like she was excluding Vivi on purpose. Sorry about Naomi. I sit down on the nearest log, and Vivi cuddles up beside me. These logs are another Verona Cove mystery. Our Stonehenge. They're huge, like petrified wood or something. They curve around the bonfire pit, unused for 364 days a year. It's not you. She's just like that. It takes her forever to like people, but she's known Ellie forever.
Oh, give her a break, Jonah.
She takes a long drink of her beer.
God, guys are so dense. Like, Honestly, I can't tell you how much your daily lives would improve if you figured out how to read body language. I blink at her, sort of pissed. What? She sighs, flicking her glance over to Adam. When that guy talked to her, Naomi totally put on a face. I've never seen her look so friendly and pleasant, but it exhausted her. I don't know who he is, but I can tell his presence has this, like, major effect on her. He's her ex. Naomi never gave details about their breakup, and I never asked. She mentioned it once, very matter of fact, around the time she left for college last year. It's like when someone eats something bad and tells you they got sick. You don't ask for details. You understand that the situation sucked, and that's all you need. You think she's still hung up on him? Maybe not hung up on, but definitely hurt. Vivi rolls her eyes at me. Honestly, Jonah, I don't know how you can live in the same house as someone who is heartbroken without sensing it. I've known since the first night I met Naomi, obviously, because I can smell heartbreak on a person. It smells like incense, sweet, but burning. I want to tell her that I live with 6 heartbroken people, one of whom is catatonic. That kind of heartbreak smells like the aftermath of a car wreck, like hot metal, oil, the chalky powder released by airbags. Anyway, she glances to see that Naomi's walking back over. I'm gonna go find Tasha real quick. Be nice to your sister. I have no idea who Tasha is. Vivi flies off in a flash of blonde and bare legs. I figured Naomi would nag me if I had a drink tonight, but she's holding 2 beer cans. Here, she says, taking Vivi's place on the log. I got us decent ones instead of the piss they're calling keg beer. She hands me a can and cracks open another for herself. Cheers to surviving this endless fucking awful year. Here's hoping. I knock my can against hers. It makes a thin aluminum clink, and we both take long drinks. She's really something, isn't she? My sister's dark eyes are watching Vivi, who is locked into conversation with some guy who is clearly not Tasha. She's laughing, occasionally pushing at his arm. I mean, she's openly flirting with him. But then she catches me looking and puckers her lips like kissing me from yards away. Her red lips stand out in the moonlight. Yeah, I chance a sidelong look at Naomi. You'd like her if you got to know her. The fire snaps in front of us, and a log splits within it. Naomi is quiet for what feels like a long time. Finally, she says, I'm just trying to hold it together. This isn't exactly an excuse for her perpetual bad mood, but I know what she means. So is Vivi. I don't know how I know this, but I do. I've never asked about the scar on her left wrist, jagged and intentional. She wears long sleeves almost all the time, or if she's in her bathing suit, an armful of bracelets. Isaac asked about the scar once, and Vivi told an elaborate story about getting attacked by a bear while camping near Mount Rainier. She's never told me the real story other than to say she isn't afraid of darkness. I believe her. Every once in a while, her temper flashes.
It's like she's exhausted from beating down her demons.
I'm not sure how much time passes, sitting beside my sister. It feels like we're the only people who are still and sober. Everyone else creates a loud, smoky blur around us. Drinking with my sister doesn't feel weird like I thought it would. This past year made us the same age. Old. Because we have real problems. Not that so-and-so broke up with me, or I failed a biology test, or will I get into Berkeley. Naomi and I are the grizzled adults drinking silently at the bar while the college kids grind on the dance floor. When Vivi reappears, she has the guy she was flirting with in tow. Yay for me. Naomi, this is Ethan, she says, with mischief in her voice. I was just telling him how you're doing an internship for your environmental engineering major. Naomi doesn't smile, too suspicious of Vivi's motives. Oh yeah? I'm a junior at Stanford, Ethan talks fast, genuinely excited for some reason. His hands clasp against his chest, like Naomi doesn't understand the pronoun I. And his eyes are locked onto my sister in a way that makes me want to punch him. Majoring in environmental engineering? This changes Naomi's expression. She softens, now looking at Ethan in wonderment. My sister is such a nerd for science, and no one in our house ever wants to hear about it. She gave up a long time ago.
I'm at Cal Poly. What's your internship emphasis?
He asks. Vivi crosses her arms, triumphant. I've been compiling a lot of pollutant data, NPS and indicator bacteria mostly, but I get to transition to some groundwater remediation type stuff soon. That's so cool. I'm working at an environmental law agency this summer because I'm thinking about going to law school. We have a big Clean Water Act case right now. Please don't take this the wrong way, Captain Planet, Vivi says, touching Ethan's arm in her overly familiar way. But this is more boring than watching glue dry. Vivi's candor can be charming. It can also be rude as all hell. Naomi looks ready to throw her into the Pacific, but then Ethan chuckles. She's right. His eyes stay fixed on Naomi.
I'm actually kind of hungry. Do you want to walk to the diner? I think it's still open. I'd love to pick your brain about the environmental influences on Verona Cove.
Sure. Naomi rises to her feet. I'm not used to seeing my sister's face so open and untroubled. I'd love to. They head off together toward town without even saying goodbye. I can hear him telling her that he grew up in landlocked Colorado, that Verona Cove's ocean life and varying terrain are fascinating to him. I stand, like I'm going to chase him down and warn him, if you hurt my sister, I will bludgeon you with a tree branch, or drown you in unclean water, or whatever you do to maim and insult an environmental engineer.
Down, boy,
Vivi says, patting my arm. He's an Eagle Scout, literally. We talked about it.
I've never seen that guy before. He could be a murderer.
She rolls her eyes.
Violet Cunningham is his cousin.
It's not like he's a drifter who hitchhiked into town with a rusty sickle.
Violet's a lifelong vacationer and well-liked enough to get a bonfire invite. But still.
Besides, Vivi says, jabbing her elbow into mine, check that out.
Naomi and Ethan walk past her ex-boyfriend and his group of friends. She doesn't even glance over. And maybe, to Vivi, it seems like matchmaking. But it honestly took me this long to realize that maybe my sister just needs a friend. She comes home from her internship and looks after the littles. She goes upstairs to handle money stuff with my mom. She cleans up around the house and does laundry and grocery shops. Same as the rest of us. I can't remember the last time I saw her with someone her own age.
That's what I call killing two birds with one stone. Except I would never kill one bird, let alone two, so that's not really the right adage. But there's no adage for, like, gave one bird a cute boy named Ethan and made another bird named Adam jealous. Oh, speaking of which, I'm getting a birthday dinner on the patio, right?
The change in subject takes me a moment.
Right. Great. Okay. So, I've been promising Leah I'd help with her peacock costume, but she wants there to be an occasion, and my birthday party seems like a good one, so I want everyone to come to dinner, and I want everyone to dress up like their favorite animal, because that will make everything perfect for me.
Yeah, all right. Why not? For the thousandth time in the weeks I've known Vivi, I wonder, what the hell have I gotten myself into?
Hooray! Oh, and don't forget to invite Officer Hayashi.
Like I would forget a request like that. I still don't quite understand their connection. I know they eat breakfast together some mornings, and I know that last week, as Officer Hayashi was leaving Tony's, he pointed at me and said, "You'll be good to that girl." Then he patted the handcuffs on his belt all menacingly.
"Hey, Vivi!"
someone calls from closer to the water. I've lived in this town my whole life, and Vivi has more friends.
"Be right back," she says, kissing my cheek. "Don't move, okay? We're talking more about my anthropomorphic birthday party." Isn't that a great word? Anthropomorphic? I'm not sure if I said it right, but who the hell gets to decide how people use language anyway? I could make up my own language if I wanted to. There's no council that certifies these things, and...
"Viv," I say. "Someone called for you."
"Oh, right."
She kisses me on the mouth this time, hands on either side of my chin, before running off. I sit by myself without even looking around for someone else to talk to. I had weird motivations for coming here tonight. It wasn't to have fun. I guess I wanted to represent my family. Like, look, we're okay. Two of us are here. I even have a girlfriend. But all that feels stupid now. We're not okay. And there's no point in pretending. By the time I finish my beer, I'm ready to go home. I've made an appearance. I've said hi. I don't have a happy face. But even my I'm okay face is tired. Vivi startles me out of my introspection, back by my side and pulling at my hand the way Leah does.
Come on, come on! It's time for skinny dipping!
It takes me a second.
I've heard skinny dipping happened at a bonfire a few years ago when I was too young to attend.
What? No.
Yeah, oh, come on, it'll be fun.
She taps my nose with the tip of her finger and glances intentionally downward. Nothing I haven't seen before. Is she serious? Or teasing me to get a reaction? I can never tell. Viv, there's no way I'm getting naked in front of everyone I know.
Oh my God, Jonah!
She rolls her eyes, and I feel like the parent of a teenager on a sitcom.
It's dark, and you'll be in the water. No one will even see.
Yes, they will. Most of the time, I feel drunk on Vivi. Lightheaded and wanting more, more, more. But then there are moments where being with her feels like a cruel hangover. Or maybe it's just that I'm cast in the role of Buzzkill.
And I don't want everyone here to see you naked either. Okay, I'll keep my underthings on then, for you, out of love.
Before I can tell her that's not really what I meant, she's off and running, already peeling off her shirt. I want to yell at her to stop, please, that this is weird. But the words feel like gunky oatmeal in my mouth, stuck to my tongue. I don't want to be this deadweight, unfun guy. It's just that I've never seen Vivi wear a bra that isn't lacy and totally see-through, and I don't want other people, you know, seeing through it. I want to be the only one who sees the colorful flower tattoo on her side, the one that she hates. There's a group of at least 10 people at the edge of the water, stripping down. Even more run down to the shoreline when they realize what's happening. Seeing a big group of naked people is surreal. My instinct is to look away because staring seems wrong. The guys are stark naked, but most of the girls are keeping their underwear on. Vivi's right. It's hard to see in the darkness. As the group runs into the water, they're a nude blur. Of course, everyone on the shore is encouraging them. I'm relieved that Naomi left, because there's probably nothing weirder than your sister seeing your girlfriend almost naked. Resigned, I find my spot on one of the logs. They're well into the waves, and I sigh. Hey. A slim figure appears between me and the bonfire, and I look up to find Ellie smiling down at me. Hey.
So, my dad tells me you're testing out some menu changes?
She sits next to me on the log, adjusting her skirt beneath her.
He's really proud.
Thanks. Proud. Like a dad. I don't really know how to feel about that. Which reminds me. Hey. I drop my voice even though no one is really close. Can I ask you a weird question? She nods.
Do you know who owns the restaurant?
Like half your dad, half my dad? And what now? Since my dad is...
Yeah, it's 50-50. Your dad's half went to your mom.
She smiles the tiniest bit. I overheard. When your brother gets in as much trouble as Diego used to, you get really good at eavesdropping. So, have you, heard your dad say anything? About how the restaurant is doing? She considers this, really mulling it over. Her brows drop and her lips pinch together.
No, but he seemed stressed, and... I've walked in on a few conversations where my mom and dad abruptly stopped talking. I figured it was about my brother's new girlfriend or something.
Why? If Felix wanted Ellie to know, he would have told her. It's probably not fair to make her worry, but based on the way she's looking at me, I think that ship has left the harbor. Don't tell your dad I told you, okay, but I accidentally saw some papers that make it seem like we're a little... behind on payments.
Huh.
The fire reflects back in her dark eyes. I didn't know. I had no idea. I don't want your dad to know that I know, but I'm trying to figure out what I can do. She nods slowly. I understand how hard it is to process. I didn't think about money.